Ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome to the roundtable and webinar on analyzing civil and criminal liabilities of directors. This event is being organized by Tata AIG Insurance and Nishit Desai Associates. The speakers for the panel discussion are Avninder Mohan, President, SL Group, Z Network, Rajiv Chaubey, VP Legal and CS, Vedanta Limited, Sushant Sarin, Senior Vice President, Tata AIG General Insurance Company Limited, Pratibha Jain, Partner, Funds and Regulatory Practice, Nishit Desai Associates, Ashish Kabra, Senior Member, International Litigation and Dispute Resolution Practice, Nishit Desai Associates. The panel discussion would be followed by the keynote speech from Mr. P.K. Malhotra, Secretary, Department of Legal Affairs. Thereafter, we would have the concluding address by Mr. Siddharth Luthra, Senior Advocate, Supreme Court of India. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode, and there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions at the end of the panel discussion. If you should need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star and zero on your touchtone telephone. Also, you can download our mobile applet, Nishit Mobile, which is available on the App Store for iOS devices, Play Store for Androids, and BlackBerry World to access the current updates and videos. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I would now like to hand over the session to Ms. Pratibha Jain. Thank you, and over to you, ma'am.
Thank you, and welcome everyone in the room and on the call. Thanks for taking out the time today to, you know, come and hear us and interact with us on this increasingly important topic. You know, covers a wide spectrum of issues with regard to operation of companies in India. I mean, the backbone of any company is its management, its directors, and we have seen with the steady opening up of the Indian economy, we've seen large number of investors coming in and putting in capital into the country. At the same time, it's the board of directors in a company which make the decision for the company and provides strategic guidance to the company and monitors the management activities. As the modern day companies confer broad discretionary powers upon board of directors and relies on them for important decision making, there's always a risk of potential abuse by directors of their powers at the expense of shareholders and investors of the company. We know we have a lot of few of our investor clients dialed in. So from that perspective, it's important to hear what the duties of the directors are so they can keep that in mind. On the other hand, for the individuals acting in the capacity of a director or an officer in a company, they're exposed to various risks involving shareholder stakeholder claim, exposure in the event of mergers and acquisitions, the liquidation, regulatory and accounting non-compliances, liabilities arising out of general and specific legislations in India, etc. The issue gains more importance as the liability may even extend to non-executive directors who typically are not involved in the day-to-day management of the company or independent directors. India has recently seen a complete overhaul of its corporate law framework with the introduction of the Companies Act 2013, which has streamlined various provisions and brought about much needed changes as regards investor protection, better governance norms, disclosure requirements, etc. The regulators in India have been on a spree to rehash the existing corporate framework and laws and regulations and tightening of liabilities overall, including criminal liability in certain cases. Given the issue of directors' liability is an age-old problem, has been revisited time and again, and with the new act very recently, our purpose today is to discuss the roles, responsibilities, liabilities, the standard of liabilities for directors of company, and how best to protect the directors from these liabilities, inform, aware, and protection. Hopefully, we'll be able to take up following on seminar in terms of, you know, what investors, you know, what rights they can have against directors in case of misuse of power. With that, let me go to my esteemed panel today. We are very lucky to have, you know, two general counsels of leading companies in India. We also have an expert in Sushant on the insurance side, and my colleague Ashish, who focuses on this issue at NDA. Let me, with this, start with you, Rajiv, if I may. Just if we can start with the broad outline. All of us have heard a lot about the new Companies Act and codification of duties for a change. You know, if you could just walk us through what the new changes are.
So good afternoon, everybody, and thanks for taking time for joining this. I will basically start with, as you know, everyone is aware that we have the new Companies Act, which is effective from 1st April 2014. And while some of the sections were notified in September of 2013, but the majority has been notified from 1st April. And the new Companies Act has actually brought a sea change as far as, you know, the liability of the directors are concerned. And added to that, I think SEBI has come out with the listing regulation, which again is reflecting broadly what, you know, is expected out of the directors and especially the independent directors. And the role of directors is going to, I think, in the coming period, is going to witness a sea change in the total approach. And I will say why, because there are various provisions in the Act, which is actually, you know, tightening the role and responsibility of the directors. So to take you first, I think I would like to refer to the Schedule 4, which is, and in fact, it will be objective to define the role of the directors in two parts. First, to start with, you know, the whole-time directors or who are actually in control of the company in day-to-day affairs. And the second part will be directors who are either non-executive and sometimes they are also independent directors. So first, to, you know, there's no need to be frightened because, you know, just you are a director on the board. But what is expected is that you should act in a very, in a diligent manner, and plus you should exercise that skill and care which is expected out of you if you are sitting on a board. And basically, if you refer to the Schedule 4 of the Companies Act, it clearly defines the code for independent directors, and it actually tells that what exactly an independent director is supposed to do. So assuming if I am sitting on a board of any public listed company, although the independent directors are also now required to be even appointed on unlisted, you know, public companies, basically whatever, you know, the conduct of the affairs of the company is concerned, or if any agenda item or if any business is coming in front of you, you should actually question taking the overall interest of the company, the interest of the shareholders and especially the minority shareholders, and should examine specific cases which are where there is a potential conflict of interest. So you should actually raise those red flags if you feel there is a potential conflict. Now, as directors, everybody has to disclose their interest and, you know, contracts in which they are interested. And it is, as a board member, it is easily available to you. And obviously, the company secretary, when he is putting up the agenda, obviously, he will disclose all the potential conflicts which are there. Not only that, you can be also assisted with the fact that now there is a whole set of regulations on related party transactions. So, in fact, if you are you have audit committee who is basically assisting you, assuming you are not an audit committee member. So one level of scrutiny is already there by the audit committee, especially on the related party transaction. So if you are, I'm just giving an example of related party transaction because most of the governance issue, if we see, is actually emanating from the related party transaction. And some of the corporate, you know, so-called frauds or scams which has taken place right from Satyam, or, you know, even if you want to take global, whether it is WorldCom or Enron, mostly it revolves around, you know, either accounting frauds or mismanagement in terms of transferring the funds of the company to a to a business related to the promoters. Apart from that, I think a lot of responsibility is there on the audit people who are on the audit committee, because now you have to ensure that there is adequate internal internal control and internal financial control. And I think that is a very important area, because if you just focus on the internal financial control and you ask the internal auditors to present, and even now the auditors also have to comment on the internal financial control. So basically, as an independent director, you should be asking all the right questions. Now, when it comes to a whole-time director, obviously the role is much bigger, because you are actually in the control of the business. You are running the day-to-day affairs of the company. So you should never lose sight of, you know, although you are a whole-time director, you should be questioning whether this decision is in the best interest of the company or not. You should not only look at the promoter's interest. So I think just to start with, and the same, you know, tone and tenor is also repeated in the SEBI listing obligation, where they have defined clearly that what are the duties of the directors.
Right. So clearly, I mean, skill, care, diligence, independent judgment, even if you're a whole-time director, and, you know, making sure you're performing your fiduciary, avoiding conflict. All of that is important also in the context of the fact that now the duty of a director is defined under the Act. Beyond
then compared to the 56 Act.
56 Act. And it's now broadly including beyond your duty to the, you know, running the company for the benefit of the shareholders. They have added other three more buckets: interest of employees, interest of environment, and interest of the community. So, you know, from international jurisprudence,
so
what we've
basically
read.
Basically, it is like entire stakeholder.
Exactly. Yeah. So and typically you wouldn't have thought of community and environment as the stakeholders. So how do you see this, Mr. Bond, if I can get to you, the broadening of your duties, how does that get translated into liability? And what sorts of liabilities also under the new Act, you know, what is the deviation from the previous Act? If I can get you to talk about civil criminal code.
Thanks a lot. Start within this even odd era, which is there in Delhi. I am only the odd man out in this even panel, because I normally deal in telecommunication, broadcasting, copyright matters, and companies that I go through or read on need to know basis whenever there is an issue about that. But be that as it may be. So correct me if I go somewhere wrong or heavier. What basically I have understood, the paradigm shift in the position of director. See, wherever the word EOR is added to some designation, it comes with a lot of importance. For example, minister, doctor, solicitor, actor, director. And once the word director comes, what I am able to gather during last 2-3 days of my research is that there is a paradigm shift now. See, the normal presumption in law is that you are liable for something if you know about it. Then in law we have got what we call the deemed liability, a fictional liability which is introduced, and it is that even if you don't know, you deem to know certain things. Factually, you do not know. But it is deemed by law that you know that particular thing. So according to me, in 1956 Act and in 2013 Act, that's the paradigm shift. Because it states that if a director attends a board meeting, That's the factually known fact. If he presents there, he participates in a board meeting, then of course he is supposed to know what is happening at the board meeting, but it goes a step further and says that even if you do not attend and the proceedings of the board are sent to you.
Exactly.
If the proceedings of the board are sent to you, you are supposed to go through it, and if you do not agree with those proceedings. Suppose I am an independent director, or for that matter a normal director, I do not attend the board meeting for one reason or the other, but after a week I receive the minutes of that board meeting. For one reason or the other, I am not able to go through those minutes. And God forbid something wrong happens because of what transpired in that particular board meeting, then tomorrow I cannot take this plea that, oh, I was not present in the board meeting, therefore I am not in know of the thing as to what actually transpired in that board meeting, because now the Act provides that if the proceedings are sent to you and you do not express your dissent, so therefore a positive act is prescribed or responsibility is cast on you, that if you do not go through those minutes or do if whatever has transpired in that meeting, if you think that something wrong has happened and if you do not object to that, you do not express your dissent, then it is assumed as if you have consented to that. And therefore, if something wrong happens, then you should be held liable. So that's a paradigm shift, and therefore, as a director, one must ensure now not only where you are present as a board member in a board meeting, you should exercise due diligence and care as to what is happening. Even if you are not attending and you are a member of the board, if the minutes are sent to you, you must go through those minutes, and if you are not satisfied, you must raise the red flag there and then. So that's the first part that I would like to point out, and here is the difference. Now, you have pointed out a very interesting thing, that is the interest of the environment also. Because now environment is a buzzword, green, 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 green everywhere. So that's an additional responsibility that has been cast, and I would like to put this issue before my panelists, and because they are expert in their respective fields, I'll come to the criminal liability part later on in the next round. Or can I continue?
Continue, and then we'll take environment.
Okay. Now, environment, I just wanted to raise one issue because the issues are likely to arise in this particular sphere as well. What is the responsibility of a director, let's say, of a cigarette company? That's the kind of issue we need to discuss and deliberate. So we'll come to that now. Now coming to the criminal liability, because I told Pratibha that I would like to cover the criminal liability part of this. Now, insofar as the criminal liability part of the director is concerned, now the normal criminal law is that you are liable criminally if you have yourself, I mean in a layman language I am putting, if you have yourself violated certain law or done something with a wicked mind, with an intention to commit that thing, and which is considered as an offense by a particular statute. So therefore an important thing for a criminal liability is what we call in our legal parlance as mens rea. So you must have a criminal intent of mind. Now when we talk this particular thing in the context of director, then the question arises, even if, for example, I explained you the paradigm shift, what has happened in the New Companies Act vis-a-vis the 56 Act. Now dehorse that, even in 56 Act, this issue was very much relevant in the sense that suppose I have not done anything which is criminally wrong, whether still I can be imputed with a criminal liability as a director, and this is what we call what is known as a vicarious liability. So vicarious liability means the liability occurring to you because of the actionable conduct of somebody else with whom you have got some kind of relationship. You have not done that act. Somebody else has done that. But because of the fact that you have got some kind of relationship with that fellow, the liability comes upon you. So that's what is known as a vicarious liability. This is basically a tort concept, a common law concept. And it is normally applied in civil law in case of, let's say, master-servant relationship or employer-employee relationship. If an employee does something wrong, then the employer is deemed to be vicariously liable. Now the question arises, how does it apply in the Company Act matter, and especially in case of directors? Now, insofar as that part is concerned, the law in this regard has gradually developed. Now, the important thing in this context is to note that a director is acting on the behalf of a company. So, therefore, if a criminal wrong is committed, can the company be held responsible for that, and can the company be criminally prosecuted? Now, I'll give you the live example of my sector itself in order to buttress this particular point and as to how the law has developed over the years. Now, if you examine the thing in more detail, you will find that the company is an artificial juristic person. It does not have a mind of its own. So therefore, the most important ingredient of fastening a vicarious liability on the company, that is the mens rea, the wicked state of mind, can it be attributed to a company? In the initial stages, when these kinds of matter went to the courts, and one of our own matter went, wherein a program was shown by us on the television, which was against a company called Sahara, which is otherwise very famous now because of other reasons. Now that company filed a criminal defamation suit against us. Now we went to the High Court and took the same plea, saying that we are a company, we are an artificial juristic person. So therefore, when it comes to, because criminal defamation is under Section 500 of the IPC, so we said that we cannot be prosecuted at all. And the High Court accepted our view. It said that the criminal liability cannot be extended to an artificial juristic person. So therefore, if it cannot be extended to an artificial juristic person, the natural corollary is that if you are working for the company, it cannot be extended to you. Now the same thing continued for certain more years. Then gradually the law developed, and in UK one particular case happened, that was Bolton Engineering Company, wherein the Lord Denning gave a very landmark judgment and said that when it comes to the company, when it comes to the criminal act done by the company, then it should be deemed that the company is being controlled by the persons, and if they have got a criminal intent in their mind, that means the persons who are controlling the company, if they have got the criminal intent in their mind, it will be regarded that they are the alter ego of the company, and therefore the company can be prosecuted for that. So that changed the entire jurisprudence which was prevalent so far. And then the matter, then when it came to the Indian part, then there was a famous case of 2005, that's a Standard Chartered case, wherein our Supreme Court also held that company is deemed to be controlled by the persons, and if they have got a criminal intent in their mind, that will be regarded as an alter ego of the company, and therefore that alter ego, if they have got something mens rea in their mind, it will be attributed to the company and the company can be prosecuted. So far, so good. Now the question arises that if the company can be prosecuted, can the liability be imputed to the directors as well? Now this particular aspect also becomes a subject matter of various judicial pronouncement, and a settled law after the pronouncement of Supreme Court is that where the statue itself provides, where the statue itself provides that the director shall also be liable for the criminal conduct of the company, the directors can be prosecuted. So, important thing for fastening a vicarious liability on the director is that the statute must provide for that. And otherwise, the normal law would apply, which is that if that director has found to have committed some criminal act, then anyway he would be liable. So therefore, insofar as the company part is concerned, if the company is an offender, and if the statute specifically provides that a vicarious liability can be fastened on the director, then the director would be held liable, otherwise not. Now this also, I would like to explain if you permit me for 5 more minutes.
Sure.
Yes. Now to throw further clarity on that, I would like to take you to an important judgment of the Supreme Court, which has been recently delivered in Sunil Bharti Mittal versus CBI in 2015. Now here, the specific issue was this. Now in 2G scam, because of certain allegations regarding the issuance of licenses, the criminal proceedings were initiated against certain companies and Bharti was one of that company. Now during those proceedings, the learned special judge issued summons to 3 persons of Bharti as well as, and one of that included Mr. Sunil Mittal, the chairman and managing director of Bharti. Now that summoning order was challenged in Supreme Court. Now in Supreme, again, the issue was whether because of the act of the company, the vicarious liability can be fastened on the director or for that matter the managing director or not. Now Supreme Court analyzed the entire case law on that, and I would like to specifically point out it's a very beautiful judgment. A very fine distinction has been made. Now, prior to that, there was a case in the Supreme Court itself. It is called Iridium Telecom Company versus Motorola. Now, in that case, the principle of law which was pronounced in that UK judgment in Bolton Engineering case, that was as it is adopted in Indian context by our Supreme Court and said, yes, the company can be prosecuted because the alter ego, that's the directors who are controlling the affairs of the company, they shall deem to have a guilty state of mind. So therefore, on that basis, the prosecution's arguments in Supreme Court were that if we have to take the alter ego's weak state of mind, then in this case, the directors who are involved in the day-to-day affairs of the company, they should also be held vicariously liable. Now, Supreme Court has now clarified in a very nice manner the entire law on this subject. The Supreme Court has held, number one, based on the Iridium judgment, the company can be prosecuted. That's number one. There is no issue about that. Second part, why the company can be prosecuted? Because, again, the same principle, the company is controlled by the persons who are the alter ego, and if they have got the mens rea, it can be. Now the act, but Supreme Court further made a distinction and said that on the basis of the act done by the alter ego, the company can be prosecuted. But the law is not other way around. That is, if the company is an accused, if the company is a principal offender, it cannot be said that the directors who are controlling the affairs of the company, based on that particular analogy or that corollary or that story, it cannot be said that the directors also can be held responsible. And therefore, if the directors are to be held responsible, again, the same principle of vicarious liability, that there has to have a specific provision in the statute. In case there is no provision in the statute, the directors cannot be even vicariously held liable. That's number one. And second, important thing I would like to point out, and it is of the practical importance in day-to-day litigation. For example, even if the even if the particular provision is there in a particular statute making the directors vicariously liable, the important thing that we have to remember in that case is that the liability of the director is secondary. The primary liability is that of the company. Now suppose in a case, directly a director is made a party, a criminal case is filed, let's say the chairman of a company, without involving the company, leaving the company out of the ambit of those criminal proceedings, can, even if a particular provision is there in the statute, can the director be prosecuted? The answer is no. Again, there is a classic Supreme Court judgment on this particular issue, that is Anita Hada's case, wherein the court held that even if a particular statute contains the vicarious liability provisions for a director, what it requires is that the company should also be arrayed as an accused, because company is a principal offender, and in case the company has not been included, that director alone cannot be proceeded with the prosecution. So that in sum and substance the law on the vicarious liability of the director is, and we must remember in all those cases, because we have got, you know, lot of cases in the court because of just putting the pressure. The chairman is made as an accused, the managing director is made as an accused, and then the harassment starts. You know, in India it's easier to obtain a warrant from the court, and all those harassment process then one person has to go through. But now, since now there is a Supreme Court pronouncement of that, so the law in this regard is more or less now quite clear. Thank you.
Thank you. Ashish, let's just take from there. Given the new Companies Act, does that help us in terms of codifying the duties and liabilities? And in which cases do you then have, you know, just going a little bit more into detail, where is the codification of liabilities of directors in the Act? You know, you, what Mr. Mohan was talking about, that there will be liable for sure.
So, as sir was pointing out, liability for directors can either be direct in terms of their direct role coupled with the criminal intent, or liabilities can flow through if prescribed by the statute, that is where the vicarious liability comes in. And this is probably then what brings us to the Companies Act. And we're discussing earlier about the recent codification. Now, one thing what codification surely does is it takes away common law. So earlier we used to rely on common law principles. Now we can't rely on those principles. Now we have a statute which is given. So probably in terms of interpretation of those duties, because to some extent there are codification of those common law principles, those case laws may be relied upon, but now that's what the statute brings in. And it also brings in an objective criteria to a degree, to a certain degree. And it says that if those duties are not met, there will be obviously repercussions. But what is more interesting in terms of the Companies Act and the changes is, and what, this is what a few changes will be noticed while going through some of our matters that were going on, is that earlier for imprisonment to be awarded to a director under the Companies Act, all these sections would have prescribed that it has to be established that the offense is committed willfully. It was not a strict liability which was being imposed on a director in terms of giving him a criminal aspect coming down to it. This appears to have been now changed in the new enactment. So if I'll give examples, section 211, 212 of the previous 1956 Act contained provisions which were related to the account, that the account should be true and fair and they should have certain in the form prescribed under the Companies Act meet the requirements. There it was given that if a violation takes place, the directors would be held responsible. Certain directors were identified that these people would be held responsible and liability would be imposed. But what a carve-out was given that would imprison the director, you have to establish that the offense was committed willfully. Until unless you establish the willfulness, you could not have imprisoned. This has now been taken out of the new enactment. So if you see under section 128 and 129 of the new act, now this is something which directors really need to be cautious of now. Because under the new enactment, it appears that the intent is to even go ahead to grant imprisonment where there is a violation taking place, and that too on a principle of strict liability. So this is something we have to be cautious of. Probably try and see if courts will now include or read into the act the requirement that to imprison a particular director, the intention should always be there. So this is one thing in terms of the companies that I want to point on the serious risks which are faced. Now, obviously, the new act has got class action provisions which are there, not notified yet. Fraud has been defined, which everyone is now well aware of, so we don't need to go into that in great detail. So companies that in that sense, and obviously there's the expression officer in default, and the fact that you are on board and the mere receipt of board papers could take you there and basically bring you within the ambit of facing the liability. So that's from perspective of Companies Act. Now, there are other enactments as well, which I personally classify into two categories. One is that MI Act, FEMA, and all those enactments, where the standard language used is person in charge of and responsible to the company for the day-to-day affairs. So there are these set of enactments where this standard language is used, which is pari materia. The other set of enactments are basically your Factories Act, your Provident Fund Act, your Industrial Disputes Act, where this language is not given, and sometimes merely on account of being a director, you can be held liable under those enactments. So broadly speaking, Companies Act, enactments where this specific language has been used, person in charge and responsible of, and the third genre, which is your Factories Act and all. So these are the broad genres where we're going in. Now, apart from this, what I also want to discuss, probably I'll take it, move on to that particular aspect, is everybody is now well aware that these are the faces of how we face liability, but we are also faced with situations where not just because of statute these liabilities are arising, but directors are also facing now there has been codification of these duties. How do I actually understand these duties in my day-to-day function? Now, most common situation of these duties and a director see having a conflict of interest is basically when we have nominee directors on board. Now, for example, we have in a JV agreement, in a private equity deal, in a basically wherever you have your shareholders agreement, you always have directors who have been nominated by certain shareholders. Now, everyone is aware commercially, the intent behind nominating that director onto the board is to have visibility over company's actions, to have control over there, and to further the interest of the shareholder who is nominating that particular director. Because the shareholder, that's why we take that board seat, that's why we take those board rights. So what happens to such nominee directors in terms of this new codification which is now coming under the Companies Act, the duties which are now codified? A lot of situations we see in terms of generally whenever disputes arise, there are situations of conflict which arise. To say a few examples, let's say in a PE investment deal, there's a PE nominated director, a PE wants an exit. The exit he may ask by listing, by buyback, that may not always be in the interest of the company. A conflict arises. How does the PE nominee director in that situation work? Let's say in a insolvency situation. Now in an insolvency situation, the interest of creditors takes the primacy. They take over rather than the interest of other shareholders and all. In that sense, how will the director who's been nominated by a particular shareholder manage his obligations towards the nominating shareholder and his obligations towards the company and the creditors? In JV agreements, we normally in JVs, most of the disputes that we are witnessing is in terms of non-compete violations. Now, in non-compete violations, the director is there for nominated shareholder. That shareholder or his director has certain other companies doing competing business. How will you work it out? A director gets certain information by being on board of the company. Can he share that information with his shareholders? Or will it be a breach of confidentiality? Because under the Companies Act, there are only certain information that a shareholder can get. Whereas under director under the Companies Act can get a lot more information. So can that information be shared by the director with his nominating shareholder that easily? So these are a lot of issues which now face, and in terms of codification, have gained a lot of significance.
Sorry, we're running out of time. I just want to welcome in the room Mr. P.K. Malhotra, Law Secretary to the Government of India. So we, you know, welcome you, and this is a panel discussion, and then we have your keynote speech. But if you have any views during the discussion, you know, we'll all more than welcome, you know, your experience and your expertise in this field. So Shan, let me just quickly go to you because, you know, you see this practically day in, day out. So we're all talking about our experiences individually, you know, for us, the clients, that we see facing issues, you know, for the general counsels, the directors they deal with. But you have numbers. So statistically, you know, have you seen
you know, any increase in the liabilities, in, increase in the claims. And just, you know, for our audience on the phone, what sort of claims do we end for Mr. Malhotra? What is the quantification in India of these claims compared to, you know, global standards?
Yeah, so we and there has been an increase in claims, and I'll talk about that. While I was listening to all of us speak about the codification of the duties and the fact that the statute today, along with a few judgments of the Supreme Court, cast a higher degree of liability on directors than earlier. One of the things that we need to do is really step out and say, so when does this liability actually arise? So what is it that I do as a director or don't do as a director, which is going to probably have an implication for me personally? And that is when what Rajiv attributed to comes into play. As a director, you have to balance between, and business is becoming more complex, so you have to balance between, you know, precariously between competing interests, and it's a difficult task. That is one. Economic growth is very good. All of us love the fact that India is growing, but a 1% decrease in market cap today is hundreds of crores of investor wealth lost. So, you know, somebody is going to hold you accountable or question you for that. So, while the Act, the Companies Act and various other judgments codify things, the fact remains that the liability will flow out of everyday business decisions that you and I take. Companies are becoming global. That's also adding to claims. And when I talk about you know, kinds of claims that we see, there's a large number of claims that are coming simply because India has a multinational footprint. There's extraterritorial laws which are starting to impact companies in India, like the FCPA, UK bribery, et cetera, et cetera. How do you deal with those? And the fact that regulatory scrutiny, the spotlight, the transparency today puts on all of us. So when we combine all this and I look at just this year, in the first 9 months, we've had 85 D&O notifications to us, which means 85 of our policyholders have had a D&O claim lodged against one or the other director or officer of the company, typically a director, a senior, you know, a director, somebody senior in the company, a KMP or somebody above. What are the allegations? Allegations are insider trading, misstatement of accounts, bribery, that's an allegation, failure to honor employment contracts, that's coming as, you know, one of the causes with the highest number of D&O claims. Revenue has become very, very activist, if I may use the word, and revenue has started issuing show cause notices to directors saying, why shouldn't you be proceeded against, and why shouldn't the penalty on you be 3x the amount of duty that you did not pay or the tax that you avoided? Okay, so revenue has become very activist. So if I were to look at two broad groups amongst various causes, revenue matters and employment contracts not being honored are really big ones. We've seen environmental claims also, and you know, it's kind of, why would there be a claim related to the environment? But it's becoming a very important thing. And this one did not come from, let's say, persons being displaced because a dam is being built or anything like that. This came because somebody imported GM tomatoes, okay, and was issued a show cause notice saying, how did you import GM tomatoes when this is prohibited by the law, and why shouldn't you be prosecuted for that? So something as innocuous otherwise as, you know, environment, we typically look at big bad disasters. Here was not something, it was a very silent thing. Maybe GM tomatoes would be bad for health, but I mean, it is not so. And liability cases are both civil and criminal. And the quantums are becoming very, very.
If we had to say between civil and criminal, what would be the, do you know, the breakup broadly?
So all the regulatory. Okay, so let me put it like this: SEBI itself has issued hundreds of, has filed hundreds of cases in criminal cases against directors for a lot of things like self-dealing and all of that. So all those are criminal in nature. Where you have to defend yourself, you don't want to be in a court of a magistrate, you don't want your management to be in the court of a magistrate, you know, representing the company. But the other bit, the rest of the cases are typically civil in nature, and it's really economic loss which is being claimed, not fine or imprisonment or anything of that sort.
Thank you. You know, Rajiv, I do want to give you the last word, but we are running out of time. But just, you know, quickly in 2 minutes, we discussed earlier about, you know, the other acts. Ashish mentioned about it, but, you know, significantly, if you had to break up between people typically focus on Companies Act and duties and perform their duties well under that and the you know, audit committee that you spoke about earlier, but how much weightage do you put to the other acts in India?
So if we look at other acts, I think Factories Act is one act which straight away comes to my mind. And there is a concept of occupier, as we everybody know. And basically the board has to appoint one of the directors to be the occupier. Otherwise, the entire board is at risk if you fail to appoint a occupier for a factory. So I think Factories Act, if you have an occupier and then if the occupier has, you know, put systems in place, in the sense commitment is there and there is a factory manager, you know, for every factory. And if you have put all the health, safety and environment system into place, I don't think, you know, there's a big issue as far as Factories Act is concerned. And apart from that, there are, you know, in India we have Act for, you know, for everything. So especially in the food area, there earlier it was the Essential Commodities Act where, you know, there were a lot of prosecutions against the directors. So there again, you need to be, you know, you should be diligent enough in putting systems and making people responsible.
Any of the regulated sector. Fair enough. And SEBI we talked about.
While one point I just wanted to touch upon, Pratibha, while there is a lot of onus on the directors, I think there is one provision in the Companies Act, namely actually sub-clause 12 of 149, which basically, you know, gives some kind of protection that you can save yourself if you have, you know, you have acted diligently and you have, you know, you have acted fairly, and something which came to your knowledge, you have questioned that, you have taken all those steps, you have not been part and parcel of any fraud, then I think there is a way out in terms of 149, sub-clause 12, which actually gives a protection.
Absolutely. And I mean, and that's the provision all of us lawyers are, you know, hoping to extensively, as long as, you know, the directors are exercising their due diligence and questioning.
Right. And one more aspect which Mr. Mohan touched is very, very apt, that as a director, there is a stipulation made that as a director, you are supposed to attend all the meetings.
Yes.
There can be an exception that you can take leave of absence for some urgent work. But if you are not attending all the meetings and then you say, I don't know what is happening in the company, I'm sorry. I'm typically talking about, you know, even smaller companies which are unlisted companies, because you know how the board is functions in case of smaller companies. And in fact, now, as a director, we have now the secretarial standards, which has become a law, which actually stipulates that the agenda should come 7 days in advance minimum. The notice has to be, the minutes has to be circulated within 15 days. Means within 30 days, the minute has to be closed. So you have all those opportunity to raise whatever concern you are having. And in fact, if you have a dissent on any of the agenda items, you should ensure that that is minuted. That is equally very important.
I'm hoping Mr. Malhotra will, you know, talk. We've discussed this before, how, you know, laws, if all of us who've practiced in India for a while go back and read the Companies Act, it's basically accumulation of reactions to various, you know, frauds that have come up in the country. So you know, we can give an example of pretty much each provision, you know, what this is a reaction to. So, you know, would love to get your views on that. But
I'm sorry, we're
really out of time.
I just want to flag one thing for Mr. Malhotra,
sure,
so that he can deliberate. I mean, directly related to this, I mean, two things have been pointed. One, Ashish very rightly pointed out a provision which is yet to be notified, the that is regarding the class action suits. Of course, that's relating to the damages part of it. Another important thing, Mr. Malhotra, I would like to point out and hear your views on that is, and that red flag has already been raised by Law Commission on that. Now, there is going to be an amendment in the Prevention of Corruption Act. Now, as per that amendment, even a private commercial organization, if an employee of that organization is found to be bribing a public servant, he would be held responsible, and there are sections in that wherein the liability then extends to the directors. And therefore, the director in that event has to prove that either he was not involved in that particular transaction, number one, or he acted normal standard phrase, diligently, he took due care,
of
and he acted in accordance with the guidelines which are there. But unfortunately, in the draft bill, there are no guidelines for the directors to follow. So therefore, in the absence of any guidelines, how you can expect a director to follow the guidelines which are non-existent? That's number one. And the second part is, again, relating to this is that why there is a blanket liability to all the directors under the proposed amendment? Why can't it be made a specific, similar to what we call when you want to fasten a vicarious liability, it has to be a vicarious liability, number one, first given by the statute, and it should be on the person who has done that particular thing, who was involved in that particular thing, or he was negligent. So that's the thing.
Fair enough. We're going to open now for questions. We'll take first, we have about 50 people on the call. So we're just going to open up the questions to them first.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one on your touchtone telephone. Participants are requested to only use handsets while asking a question. Anyone has a question may press star and one at this time. A reminder to our participants, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and one.
No questions. That's very good.
Anybody from here?
Ma'am, we have no questions.
Yes, no.
On the
Thank you. We take the questions in the room, please. If you can just give your name and your organization.
Is there any way under law and especially under the shareholder documentation can differentiate the liabilities of directors versus the investors? We are not independent directors. Maybe we are not even nominees, right? So not directors are more institutional as such. Versus some of the directors, can you, is there a way to protect your, I mean, your, how are your liabilities compared to that of some of them?
Sure. So I'll take that. Few things we need to be cautious of in terms of carving out your liability is, as Raji sir pointing out, under the new Companies Act Section 149.12, it creates a carve out for independent and non-executive directors. So obviously you won't qualify as independent, you can only qualify as non-executive. Non-executive, when you do the form filing with ROC, when the director is being appointed, you will notice that they give the options in which you can choose. So you go and ensure that at that point in time, you have done as a non-executive director. Thirdly, you have it well documented in your agreement, in your articles, that the investor or nominee will be appointed by the investor would be a non-executive director. So obviously that also helps. And lastly, in terms of your board documentation, what you have. So these are the few steps which you should definitely take to ensure that you are qualifying as a non-executive director. So this will protect your liability to that certain extent. Obviously, as I was putting the question earlier, confidential information, sharing of all of that, your information rights which you normally have in your shareholders agreement, you get those in your articles, and that probably to a certain degree eases out your burden of how do I tackle with these situations. So these are the few steps which you can take in terms of trying to alleviate your risk that the P investor directors or otherwise normally get in that sense.
I'll just add one thing. What we've started advising clients is, don't be a director at all. Take an observer seat. Take whatever rights you want
whatever matters are important as reserve matters, which require your prior approval as a shareholder.
Shareholder.
So even before a board meeting, they come to you, take approval. And the observer's role is just to ensure that the meeting's held properly and, you know, your mandates are actually followed and there's not, you know, fraud going on in the meeting itself and you never find out for 2 years.
May I just add for your benefit, if your company or the companies that you're investing in, if you make it a point to have DM insurance, all policies today provide that for non-executive directors, there is an amount which is reserved over and above the amount which would be used for claims otherwise. So, you know, knowing the special nature of the NEDs, where you don't really exercise direct control, have this fallback option after all other, you know, remedies have been exhausted. Something
in the context of D&O insurance and why we have also seen, because we have dealing matters where sometimes insurance agencies are again paying off the other experts or professionals who are involved in those matters. Why it sometimes becomes critical is even if you have taken all the steps as we're discussing right now, even if we have documented all of that, that may not always prevent initiation of prosecution. Prosecution can always be initiated by someone on someone's complaint. We know in all the other enactments through the case laws which are there, you all you need to make sure is in your complaint have one sentence, he was the person in charge and responsible of. Now whether he is or not, we'll see it at the time of trial. Let the prosecution be initiated. So in those situations, having those precautionary mechanisms is good because when they go to the trial, I will have those things to take those defenses. But D&O insurance at that point in time safeguards you from this unnecessary cost and that which you would face. And otherwise, if you again sort of go down on cost and create that as an issue at that point in time, you don't want to do it, especially when directors are facing personal liability. So this is some areas where we actually seen D&O insurance in that sense working out and being very helpful to people who are facing prosecution coming out of it. And it's something you can also negotiate with the promoter or the investor. And promoters are now, it's a defined term under the Companies Act now, unlike the previous enactment. So you can negotiate with them and also have them as incorporated as part of the agreement that you're making.
And practically have somebody who's a foreigner are based outside India, because when it comes to criminal liability, that's your first defense. I'm not in India.
Thanks very much. Very helpful.
Anyway, my name is Dr. J.S. Vijay. I'm talking from the standpoint of a non-executive independent. You see, for example, you hold about 4 to 5 meetings a week. I'm talking from that particular angle. Now, in the 2 hour, 3 hour meeting, only half hour meeting, all you are supposed to know what that is going in the company. You look at what agenda comes to you, maybe ask some questions, and then take it to see on the business agenda comes. How you can be responsible as you are incorporating a new act for all what has been happening in the company. Even if you check bounces, all the directors, independent directors are called up in the courts. I think this is a kind of horrendous situation which will become very different. Many people are shutting me independently. I have learned from 2 of them myself in the last year. But it's a very, very bad situation.
Yeah, in fact, there are 2 kind of cases. One is where it is a listed company and one is an unlisted company.
Listed company.
So on listed company, if you actually see the provisions of the SEBI listing regulation, they have actually, you know, specifically written that as an independent director, you can call for any information you want. You can hire experts where you feel that, you know, I need the expert opinion. And especially if you are a member of audit committee, you can call the internal auditors and you can tell, basically the internal auditor is now obligated to report all, you know, cases of internal financial control or internal process controls which are not as per the policy. And now there are a lot of policies which is put in place. Like, for example, every company is supposed to have a related party policy. So you can ask for a, you know, internal audit on whether all the transactions are done on arm's length or not, just to give an example. So there are many such provisions, many such rights which has been given to the independent directors. So if you exercise your rights, I think you will be always, you know, safe. Plus, especially now the auditors has a duty to report, you know, fraud, which has now been notified. I think I don't recall the amount beyond which the auditor has to report. And if the amount is below that threshold limit, the, you know, your own, the company finance team has to report it to the board. So any indication of small fraud which is happening is actually give you an indication of what is happening in the company. So now internal audit is compulsory. The auditor has a lot of responsibility to report to the director. Plus, all these powers which has been given to you, you have to actually start exercising. And I think if you are diligent enough, you know what is happening in the company, I think you are absolutely fine.
So the standards, I'll quickly wind up because I think we'll take it after Sir's keynote speech.
For the benefit of everybody.
Okay, go ahead.
My question is to Mr. Mohan and others. First is, can a company stand alone be prosecuted for conspiracy? This was the proposition that Jethwani argued in every case. It is no longer right that you have to.
If you don't mind, can we hold the two questions? I don't want to delay Sir's keynote speech. And then, you know, we're all here. It's Friday evening. We have nice cocktails. So we can continue this for as long as people want to stay. With that, sir, I will hand over to you. I don't think I need to give an introduction. Everybody in this room knows you, knows your contribution. You have been legal advisor to pretty much all the important ministries in the government, Ministry of Finance, Ministry of Commerce, Labor, pretty much all the issues that we've been dealing with here, the cabinet secretariat. So, and, you know, very important projects that you're working on. So, you know, even if we can just hear broadly on the topic and also, you know, all the other important projects that you're dealing with so people know the good work that's being done. Over to you.
Good afternoon, friends. I think Pratibha, by design, probably decided that I should not attend this panel discussion. That is why she said 3 to 4 panel discussion and just come at 4 o'clock. But I also thought that if I'm dealing with the general counsels with whom I have been interacting earlier also, why I should not take this opportunity and as a student of law, learn something from the general counsels who are in fact day in, day out, dealing with companies matter and facing problems. Because sitting in the Ministry of Law and Justice, we deal with the problems at macro level. You people sitting in the company deal at micro level. Like the issues which have been discussed, some of the issues which have been discussed. Of course, I think Mr. Avanindra Mohan, when I entered the room, he was talking about the director's liability. He was talking about criminal liability of the directors and the case law. I thought I will be discussing it, but I think whatever I wanted to discuss has already been discussed by him, and there is no need for me to repeat all those because the legal position is very clear on those issues, and he has very ably summarized that position, quoting all the relevant decisions, including the latest one with regard to that Sunil Bharti Mittal's case, where it talked about the vicarious liability, court talked about the vicarious liability, and also talked about that if only company has been listed in the FIR, then probably the managing director cannot be summoned. Or he should also be made an accused, only then you can summon him. So I think that position has been clarified. I need not go into that. But let me share with you that with the coming into force of the new Companies Act, of course, all the provisions have not yet come into force. Some are yet to be enforced. I think the responsibility of the general counsels in the companies has increased. Your duties have increased, your responsibilities have increased, and it is through you that the directors discharge their duties. If you exercise the due diligence and give proper guidance and advice to the directors, I think the companies can function in a better way, and more particularly the enlisted companies, the interest of the shareholders, more particularly the minority shareholders, will be protected in a better way. So I think my request will be that you should be now a little more sincere in discharging your duty than what you have been earlier. Now, all of you know, I mean, the new Companies Act, many new things have been brought. I know there has been a lot of criticism. There are many mistakes. There are many provisions which are probably cannot be enforced. There are issues with regard to interpretation of some of the provisions. But without going into all that, let us look at it, what good things this legislation has brought. Any new legislation which is brought, let me be very frank with you, because I'm working with the government for the last four decades. The kind of thought process which we used to go earlier while drafting a legislation, probably that time is not available to us, that kind of expertise is not available with us, and therefore there is a possibility that many a time the draftman or the person who is assisting the draftman in drafting that legislation, he doesn't understand the ground reality, therefore some lacuna or gaps are left in the legislation. But that doesn't mean that the legislation should not be implemented. Nowadays what happens, before we start implementing the legislation, because there are certain lobbies which work, they come and immediately ask for amendment in the act. Somehow this is not a healthy practice. Allow the law to operate for some time. Once you start operating a law, you come across many difficulties yourself, then you get some input, and maybe then the perfection which you want to bring will come with your experience, and when you start implementing it, the difficulties when you face, then you remove those difficulties and probably the law can be perfected. Some issues have been raised here with the, I think, very interesting issues have been raised. One is with regard to class action suit. Of course, it has not yet been implemented, but once implemented, you look at it from the shareholder's perspective. I myself was a presiding officer of the Securities Appellate Tribunal, SEBI Appellate Tribunal in Bombay for 2.5 years, and I have seen that how the individual shareholder, the minority shareholders, their interest is compromised. Thanks to the Securities and Exchange Board of India, which is one of the most important regulator as on today, although many regulators have been constituted. You have the Insurance Regulatory Authority, you have the Pension Regulatory Authority, you have the Petroleum Board, you have TDSAT. In the economic sector, so many regulators have been constituted. But I would like to compliment SEBI that it is discharging its duties to the best of its ability, and the kind of expertise which should come is now slowly coming up. It was not there initially for about a decade or so, but after that, the kind of expertise which has come and way the market is being regulated, the shareholders' interest is being protected. Talking about the new companies, that some salient feature which I would like to highlight here is, I mean, the one-man company class action suit and provision for disgorgement of gains. Whenever company is committing a fraud or some fraud is committed, and thereafter company has gained, unreasonable profit comes to the company, it can be disgorged by the government. There was no specific provision now in the Companies Act, and where this money will go, because it is a money which doesn't belong to the company, and it is not a money which has been collected as a tax, so where should it go? So the provisions are very clear, as it is in the Customs Act, as it is in the Excise Act, it will go to the Investor Education and Protection Fund. So a separate fund is created whereby the investor is also educated, and this fund is used for protection of the interest of the investor. And a time may come when this fund gets so much of money that maybe the loss which has been suffered by the investor can also be given to the investor from this fund. It may not happen immediately. It may take some time. I think this is a very, very important change which has been brought into the law for protecting interest of the investors. Then obviously we know about the corporate social responsibility. I think I get views on both sides. That is a very good step, and there are few who say no, it should not be there. Which other country has got this kind of obligation under the law? It should be voluntary. Yes, I think for certain companies which are really true to the system and to feel that, well, in this particular country, in this economy itself, we are earning profit. If we are earning profit, a portion of this profit should be spent on the welfare of the community and the society. And I think to an extent, I personally feel this is a good step. But yes, I mean, the other school of thought which says that, well, it should not be made mandatory is also, I mean, worth consideration, because there are certain companies which feel that I have paid my taxes, I have paid my duties, why should I share my profit with the common man? But the fact remains, you are living in an economy, you are living in a country, you have used the resources of the country, you have polluted the environment, is it not necessary that you should compensate for that? I think there are views on both sides, so I'm not saying this way or that way. Another important feature is constitution of special courts for expeditious of commercial disputes. I think this is one area which is very, very important. Now I'll share just two instances, persons known to me and the responsibility of the directors who are being discussed here. It is in that context I'm sharing with it. A friend of mine, who himself is a leading practitioner in tax matters, now he must be 90 plus. He is facing a criminal case of check bounce because he was an independent director in one of the companies. And that he is Delhi based. The case is going on in Bombay court.
O.P. Sapra.
Oh, you're given the name also. You're given the name also. The fellow says, I don't know what wrong I have committed. A friend of mine told me to be an independent director in the company. I became an independent director. The check has bounced. I have not signed the check. I have not participated in the meeting. It was said, and it was, I think, very rightly pointed out by Ashish. These are all things of merit. Court will say, okay, I'll discuss when the case is finally argued. And when the case will be finally argued, God only knows. For the last 15 years, he is fighting this case. Similarly, another person, he is Bombay-based. Again, a retired government servant who retired about maybe 20, 25 years back. Similarly, he was also roped in as an independent director in one of the company which is its headquarter in Bhopal. For the last 10 years, he travels to Bhopal every time, spend money from in his pocket. The man who was floated the company, he has vanished. This fellow, because he is sincere, he is running from pillar to post that something should be done. And the court says, no, first you deposit the money. You appear, then you are granted bail, then on every date when he goes there, he gets next date, which is after 3 months or 2 months. I think this area need to be checked somehow. And how it can be done, maybe you people who are expert in this area can throw some light and give some guidance how it can be done. Legislature from its side decided that this type of cases should be dealt with by the special court so that they can be disposed of expeditiously. Because you can only give a platform. Beyond that, implementing it on ground, it all depends on the people who are running that system. If the advocate themselves are not cooperating, seeking adjournment unnecessarily, or the judge feels today there are 100 matters before me, I'm going to hear only 5 cases, less 95, I'm going to adjourn, without bothering about it, what is going to happen, then probably the situation is not going to improve. Yes, we know our courts are overburdened. To reduce their burden, efforts are being taken. Like take for example, we are all moving towards e-governance. It's not that the e-governance has started today. Right from the day the process of liberalization started way back in 1991-92, when Mr. Narasimha Rao was the Prime Minister and Manmohan Singh was the Finance Minister, from that day itself it's going on. But it has been accelerated during the last 1.5 years. Now we talk about e-governance, and when we are talking of e-governance, we are not simply talking about use of mobile phone or of the computer or going on the internet and getting information that which case is coming on which date. When we are talking of e-governance, we are talking of reducing the regulations, we are talking of reducing the number of enactments, we are talking of simplifying the procedures, we are talking of paperless, faceless, cashless offices. Please don't understand me when I'm saying cashless that you are not to pay anything. Cashless means the transaction will be through your online electronic channels or maybe through your credit card or whatever it is. So, and in this direction, let me share with you, I mean, I can share in this room because our discussions had concluded only yesterday night at 9:30 when PM finally addressed us. The Prime Minister was so much concerned about the governance that for the last 1.5 years, government has taken so many steps. But still the feeling at the ground level is nothing is happening. Things have not changed. Rightly so. I also feel the same way because I get input from the people. What he did, he met all of us all the secretaries to Government of India, to be precise, about 85 of them, on 31st of December, in the evening at 6:30, we thought he's going to say us Happy New Year and tell us what you are going to do. We'll be offered a good tea and dinner thereafter, maybe. But when we went there, it was a just like a classroom where 85 chairs were there. A big bag was there having three books, a notebook, and a pencil. And there was a podium like a classroom. He came there, stood there. He said, for 1.5 years, we have been talking goody-goody. We have done so many things. We have taken so many steps. We have changed laws. We have brought New Companies Act. We have brought Commercial Courts Act. We have amended the Arbitration Act. We have simplified so many forms. We have said that when you have to file a document in the government, no attestation from notary or gazetted officer is required. You can simply attest it yourself and document will be accepted. In spite of all that, why the common man feel that no change has taken place? He said, I'm not going to say anything to you. What he did, he came prepared. There was a presentation before us. And in that presentation, he constituted 8 group of secretaries. And to each group, he gave a topic. He said, I'm not going to say. Tell me in this particular, take for example, good governance. For good governance, what should be done so that the benefit reaches to the man on the ground? What we should do? You discuss yourself. Come to me, make a presentation to me, and then let us see how best we can proceed further. So 8 different group of secretaries, each group comprising about 11 or 12 secretaries, made a presentation to him on different dates. Yesterday was the last day of presentations. And the kind of ideas which came during that discussion, and he said it, that all those people who are working at the secretary level in the Government of India, and this has never happened in the past, let me share with you, for the four decades I've been working with the government, Prime Minister directly dealing with all the 85 secretaries of the Government of India, having one-to-one views without interrupting for 2 hours. It's a great credit to that man. In any case, I'm not promoting Mr. Modi, but whatever is my experience, I'm sharing that here is a government which is working with good intention, which want to bring some sanity in the day-to-day working so that the common and the man on the ground, he gets benefit. And the benefits of e-governance reaches him, and whatever benefits government is giving in various schemes given by the government, that reaches actually to the man and is not eaten up by the middleman. So all these 8 groups had made a presentation to the Prime Minister on various dates, which ended yesterday night at 9:30. And then he said, I'm more than happy because there was no mandate from anybody. And mandate to us was, we have not to discuss ourselves. Go to the industry people, discuss with them, share their thoughts with you. Share their thoughts with you, and you also share your thoughts with them, and what exactly can be done. In the process, we also had gone to different places. We visited certain NGOs. We met people like Nandan Nilekani. We met people like Narayan Murthy and had ideas from them. The kind of presentations which we had made, in case we are able to deliver those results in the time frame within which we have set for ourselves, something to be completed by the end of 2016, certain areas to be covered by 2017, certain areas to be covered by 2018. If really we can do, I think the total scenario here will change. And once you are able to simplify your procedures, once you are able to remove the interface between the service provider and the service user, the consumer, I think 50% of your problems are solved. We have taken a mandate that most of the forms which we have prescribed for getting these services, they should be at least only a single page form. And if some information is available within the government domain, the individual will not be asked for that information. Suppose we are using Aadhaar for providing a service. You connect through that Aadhaar all other services which are available. Take for example, you have a depository where all the universities have deposited the certificates of all of you individuals. Now, if my certificate, what is my qualification, if that is to be known, if it is available within the system, I need not be asked. Through my Aadhaar number, it is connected. You can always say that this is the qualification. I did my master's from such and such university. I did my master in law from such and such university. I did such and such. Information is available. Individual will not be asked. If my date of birth is to be checked up, it should be connected with the municipal record. So we are moving in that direction. And at the same time, we are reducing the number of laws for the common man, And I think this one step which I'm taking is reducing the number of tribunals in this country. Now, although I'm a party to it, the Companies Act, I mean, when it was passed by the president, probably it might be my signature because I was a secretary concerned at that time. But if today I look at it, I find there are many things which need to be again looked into. But one good thing which has been done in this is your dispute resolution, so far as companies is concerned, now will be going only to one body, that is the National Company Law Tribunal, instead of going to High Court, instead of going to BIFR, instead of going to Company Law Board. And we have tried to ensure that the people who will be manning this tribunal are really good people coming with good experience, not only from the judicial side, from the company side. They are the professionals, they are from the companies, and they are from the profession. There has been a balance in that. I'm very, very optimistic that this will very soon get functional because process is on, and very soon the appointments will be completed. But speaking for myself personally, I'm not very comfortable that even for commercial disputes, you should have number of layers where appeal go. That number need to be reduced so that there is a finality that can be acquired as expeditiously as possible. You know, as in today, time is money. A businessman doesn't want to spend his time in litigation. More particularly, when a foreign investor is coming to this country, the first question asked by him is, in India, litigation takes too long. I don't want to block my money there. That's a question which is asked to us. Precisely for that reason, if you ask my personal view, I personally feel National Company Law Tribunal should be the final authority. Thereafter, it is only on question of law that appeal should go to the court, and there should be no other body in between. Creating one more layer will further delay the proceedings. Similarly, we are promoting in a big way the alternate dispute resolution. You know, mediation centers are working throughout the country in all the high courts. But mediation, normally for commercial disputes, people don't prefer mediation. They go for arbitration. We have amended the Arbitration Act. Probably all of you know about it. The Arbitration Act, I think it was in process for amendment for the last 13 years. The first bill was introduced in 2003. The process started in 2000. First bill was introduced in 2003. But fortunately, because I was, when this law commission gave a report, I was party to the law commission also as ex officio member of the law commission. When it came to implementation, I got an opportunity to get the bill drafted and introduced in the House. Of course, it is not strictly as per the recommendation of the law commission. Certain modifications were made on the basis of input which we got from some other experts in the field, like Attorney General, Solicitor General, Mr. Harish Salve, other people who are into the field of arbitration. And some very good steps have been taken which are not available anywhere else in the world. No legislation prescribes for it. Maybe the individual arbitration institution may be providing it, but no law anywhere in the country provide for this. Like we have said, that in case the parties themselves are not agreeing for a fee, then High Court, while appointing an arbitrator, how it will fix the fee? We have given a tentative schedule. It is only a guiding thing because arbitration is between the two parties. It's a private affair. It is only when the parties themselves are not agreeing, then the law comes into force. Therefore, we have provided that mechanism. And what we have also given a time limit of 12 months. When I prescribed this time limit of 12 months, there are a lot of hue and cry, more particularly from the arbitrators. How can a dispute be decided within 12 months? How can a dispute be decided within 12 months? It's just not possible. I said it is possible. If you are going to handle 50, 60, 70 arbitration matter at a time, obviously you can't give a decision in 12 months. But if you are handling, say, 2, 3, 4, or 5 arbitration matter at a time, you finish one, take up the another, surely you can dispose of. So I think that was accepted. Parliament accepted it. What we have gone a step further. We are not only given 12 months period. We have given liberty to the parties that in case for some reason it cannot be disposed of within 12 months, extension up to 6 months is permissible. But then on what condition? that every month there will be a reduction of fee by 5%, which is a disincentive to the arbitrator. But we have not gone only with disincentive. We have got an incentive also. If it decides early, then you get additional fee in case the parties are agreed. So with this kind of incentive and disincentive, we have tried to regulate the arbitration, which got a bad name, and that is why people started going to Singapore, Hong Kong, or UK. They were not coming to India because we want to promote India as a hub for international arbitration, more particularly in commercial disputes. And we are moving in that direction. As in today, we have provided the infrastructure for decision of commercial disputes. We have provided separate commercial courts. Law has been passed. I don't want to go into the detail of all that because of the shortage of time. But there also, a major change has been brought. I don't know whether you people have noticed it or not. In all these commercial disputes, not only we have constituted commercial courts at the district level as well as at the high court level, what we have said, we have simplified the procedure. The procedure laid down in the CPC will not be applicable to such cases. The procedure has been tightened. Within given time frame, you must file your claim. Within given time frame, you must file your reply. Within given time frame, you must file your arguments. Within given time frame, the court must give its a decision. And within given time frame, the appeal must be disposed of. And there is provision for heavy cost also. And the losing party pay, that principle has also been incorporated in these provisions, and that discretion has been given to the court. I think all these steps which we have taken will definitely improve the litigation system, more particularly under the companies of NCLT, arbitration, commercial disputes, the settlement of commercial disputes, and the kind of other provisions which have been brought. We are going to give a very, very comfortable environment to the foreign direct investor as well as to the business community so that they can concentrate on their business activity instead of fighting litigation. And I think if the provisions are rightly implemented, and once this our model of CPC, amendment in the CPC, which has been incorporated for the commercial courts, in case it becomes successful, my anxiety is that this should be implemented in respect of all civil litigation in the country, and the CPC should be amended in the days to come, so that the kind of adjournments which the professionals are taking. But let me tell you one thing. Howsoever good legislation we may have, its success depends on the person who are responsible for implementing it. I think the same thing was said by Dr. Ambedkar when we made our constitution. He said, you make however good constitution, but its actual implementation will depend on the person who really implemented. Same thing applies here. If the advocates still continue their old practice of seeking adjournment at the drop of the hat, probably system will not work. If the courts also keep on giving adjournments the way they are doing, probably the system will not improve. I think there is a need to properly implement it. Implementation is more important than the law itself, and for which it is not the government alone. Litigant has to cooperate, the professionals have to cooperate, the judiciary has to cooperate, and the companies have to cooperate. Only then this system will succeed. Well, I think the main idea was to discuss the Companies Act, but I think I have gone beyond my mandate. Few questions were asked, I think, during the course of discussion. And bribe by director, I think Sushant mentioned about it, and criminal cases by regulatory bodies. I think these are the areas on which our laws have not yet acquired a kind of maturity. They are still at the developing stage. Like in respect of liability for the companies or company can be prosecuted. Suppose you are prosecuting a company in respect of an offense where only imprisonment is provided, no fine is provided. How you are going to implement it? And as in Sunil Bharti Mittal's case itself has been said, unless the managing director or director responsible for the affairs of the company himself is made a party, and you can say that this particular person was a directing mind, unless that element is brought into, probably you can't punish the company if the law itself provides punishment only as imprisonment. So I think these are some areas on which law is still developing. Class action suit, I think, is a positive step. But only thing is, it has to be used with caution so that companies are not exploited by a group of people. Because ultimately, what your idea is to protect the interest of the
minority
shareholders and the minority shareholders. If keeping that in view, the law is implemented, I don't see anything wrong in class action suit. Similarly, we, I think Mr. Avanendra mentioned about PC Act being made applicable to the private companies, and he wanted my views on that. Well, I am of the view in today's scenario, you can't think of public sector companies or government or private sector companies in watertight compartments. The concept of PPP, which has come, where private sector participation is there in the public projects also. And ultimately, it is for the benefit of the community. It is for the development of the economy. In case there is an element of bribery involved in that, why a person in the private sector should also not be prosecuted in case he indulges in this type of offense? I think with that, and then we have commitment under the United Nations Convention Against Corruption, where when I remember, I think about 7-8 years back, when we were not a signatory to this convention, India was being criticized that corruption is rampant in this country, still you are not signing this treaty. And why we were not signing, we were saying that we are not compliant with our obligations under this convention. And one of the obligations was that private sector and the foreign companies should also be covered in this. But our law was deficient in that. One view was that first let us make our law compliant and then ratify it. But then I took a stand at that time, which was accepted by the government, that you accept reservation for these two categories and at least ratify rest of the provision of the convention so that internationally we become compliant and probably we get a good name that at least this country is also serious about removing corruption in the system. And now just to give effect to that only, so that we can, whatever reservation we have expressed to the international convention, that reservation also goes, so that this area is also covered. And it happens in many of the big deals, more particularly procurement cases by defense or other ministries, there are private players who indulge in this type of practices, and that need to be curbed. And unless there is a proper law, probably we won't be able to cover it. Well, I think there are many other points, but some of these points I will leave for your discussion 5 onward, because that will be the right time when your mind will be working, I think it will be more fertile than it is now. I don't want you to detain any more. Thank you very much. This is what I all wanted to share with you. In case you have any issues on which you would like me to react, of course, I think, but I have to rush for another meeting. Just keep time frame in mind. Maybe two questions.
Sure, sir. We'll open up for questions. Just one suggestion, sir. Today we tied up with an organization called Sadka Maya. Mr. Swaminathan is leading the effort. And it's basically an organization of general counsels who have a very strong research interest. And, you know, I've always felt, having come from the community non-private practice, that there needs to be an interaction directly between the general counsels and the government. So I'm going to, you know, encourage them to start, you know, providing their inputs on, you know, some of the key issues that you have outlined that you're already working on. I think, and the laws that have already come into place and where, you know, they can provide the practitioner's viewpoint rather than, you know, law firms where we see one client and we react. I think coming directly from them would be very helpful. We'll quickly take up a couple of questions for the... Please.
I request you to elaborate on independent directors. How they can be saved. So the law has changed, but people who are already working, they were not aware of this, that kind of stuff, and they were just entangled in the whole
No, as I told you, it's not that the system is not there or the protection under the law is not available. Question is its implementation. The two examples which I gave, in case the case is heard expeditiously, where is the difficulty? They can prove that on the basis of record, whatever evidence you have collected, we have no direct role, and probably they can be acquitted by the court. Question again, as I said, is legal framework is available. Problem is with its implementation, with its execution, and the delays which are taking place in final hearing in such matters. I think what Pratibha has told, let me be very frank with you, at least I am one of those bureaucrats or officers in the Ministry of Law and Justice who love interacting with people who can really give an input. And I don't mind sharing my thoughts and getting input from NGOs, from general councils, from any other organization, not necessarily a government department, because this widens our horizon also. We work in a particular system in an environment. There are many things which doesn't come to our knowledge, or they come to our knowledge only after we have done something. Now, take, for example, in this commercial courts bill itself. I mean, originally when we implemented it by way of an ordinance, there were certain flaws. But by the time we introduced the bill, some NGOs approached us and told us, well, there is a difficulty in this with regard to filing of appeal. And in the meantime, we got a judgment from Delhi High Court also. And we corrected it. So that way, I can tell you, government is always open to any good suggestion which is coming. But if some suggestion is coming with some vested interest, probably that becomes a problem for us for implementation. But anything which is coming with an open mind is always welcome. Yeah, please.
Three cases of criminal prosecution, and I think all three were from Andhra Pradesh. The first was the arrest of the BMW vice president, then in Ghaziabad, or I think it was in Ghaziabad, by the
Samsung.
And then again in Hyderabad, it was the Amway vice president. The interesting thing is, all three were cases of, BMW was actually a consumer, it was a consumer case, but the other two cases were essentially commercial contracts. That commercial party was taking the other side to court and to a criminal court and was prosecuting it. Now, we've seen the amendments in commercial court bill and in arbitration, how it's expedited. You yourself spoke about check counting case. So is there an effort to amend IPC so that commercial contracts which are being given forcibly with criminal nature, whether that gets treated differently? Because just by way of another example, if you look at a lot of regulator enforcement, we can take Nestle's case, there is not a knee-jerk reaction to arrest someone. So regulators, by and large, you know, they take a certain phase to before criminal action is initiated. So the concern seems to be more that private parties are using or probably misusing the criminal machinery to, you know, bring someone to the settlement table. So is there effort to amend IPC so that commercial disputes do not block, you know, the criminal justice system?
I think this is a very valid question which we have raised. And this thinking has been going on within the government and probably Finance Minister and Mr. Ravi Shankar Prasad, Communication Minister, both of them have been on record saying that in commercial disputes or in commercial cases, use of criminal law by vested parties needs to be cut and steps need to be taken in that direction. Well, I don't know actually the proposal has really been moved or not, but yes, the thought process is on. It is under consideration. However, whether any immediate change will be brought in the law or some protection need to be given immediately, I think no final decision has been taken on that so far.
In fact, just to add on, there have been cases in the past,
yes,
where recent cases of one of the officers of Make My Trip on a service tax demand has been arrested. And there have been cases, you know, in the past as well, where actually the liability of the tax is on the company, but even some of the officers have been arrested due to maybe high-handedness of the officer who was involved. I think that should also be addressed.
Stop a man from filing a criminal case. We have to see what is the problem. People are not afraid of taking a criminal case. Ultimately, we know the conviction rate in India is hardly as per, not even in the 20 or 21. What is the problem is, if you follow the rule which was laid down by Justice Krishnaiyar and Motiram, bail is the rule, jail is the exception. Why don't you make even a non-mailable offense? Why the procedure for granting enlarging a person with bail should be make objective criteria for enlarging a person on bail. People are not afraid of facing a criminal case.
No,
you can't stop a man from filing a criminal case.
Yes.
You will definitely drafting people are there to bring some elements of cheating. But what we need to ensure is the provision of bail, that's what Justice Krishna has. Bail is the rule. If you go to trial court, they are not extending bail as a police despite 41.
And especially on those cases where there is no criminal history.
Section 41 has put a lot of restraint, but still bail has not become the rule.
Correct. You see, this is...
If you enlarge people on bail, and especially when they are in the basic class, to my mind only there are three conditions for enlarging a person on bail. Is he ready to face the trial? Is he going to abscond? Is he going to tamper with the evidence? If the, all the three conditions are satisfied, even in non-bailable offense, you enlarge him on bail. Supposing we do that, people are not hesitant to face criminal case. We know what happens in criminal case.
You see, there is a paradox in what you are saying. On the one hand, you are saying that cases are registered, criminal cases are registered at drop of a hat very conveniently. But on the other hand, if you ask the common man, he will tell you, if I go to the police station, he has to, I mean, break his head to get an FIR registered.
I think, sir, so
and these are two different things. So I'm not going into that. Again, my answer will be the same. My answer is, it depends on the people who are implementing the law. There is nothing wrong in the law. There is clarity in the law. You have very rightly quoted Justice Krishna Iyer, who has said bail and not jail is the rule. And this has been reiterated number of times, and the three points which you have said, that on these basis only, if in case any of these parameters is met, only then the bail should be refused, otherwise the bail should be granted as a matter of right. I mean, this is what the law is. Even there is a law which says, 436A, which says, if an under trial has undergone half of the imprisonment for the offense for which he is booked, and he is still an under trial and the charge sheet has not been filed, he should be released. But when it comes to implementation, it is not happening. See, I personally feel, and there are two type of judges at the lower level nowadays. One, when a matter goes to him, he says, well, here is a man who has committed some wrong, he is before me. Trial will take 7 years, 8 years, 10 years. Fine, and ultimately he will be acquitted. So if as an under trial he is undergoing this for some time, that itself is a punishment for him, therefore I will not grant a bail. That is one. Second type of judges are, well, I'm doing my job. Tomorrow I may get a stricture from the High Court that why you released him a bail, there must have been some motive, that is why you have released him. Therefore, I'll not give a bail. You go to the High Court, get a bail there.
Correct, correct. Very right.
These are two type of persons who are creating problem for us. Sitting as a judge, he must behave like a judge and not as a bureaucrat or as a person who is doing service. If he feels, I'm doing my job, I have to save my job. If that feeling comes, then you are not true to the chair which you are holding. One has to be very clear on that. So the problem is not with the law when it comes to grant of bail. Problem is only with the regard to its implementation by the person who are responsible for implementing it.
The second thing is, there must be objectivity or principles for deciding a case. Cases which I would like to highlight, one is that of the actor, which we all know, one is of the chief minister, we all know. Same set of facts, there a trial court convicts and the High Court says no case made out. It is very surprising, black cannot become a white, two learned man, one says absolute case made out. The other, it is very surprising, who is wrong? Are we having objective standards for deciding cases? If you ask a nursery boy, why can't become a black? Or somebody is wrong, whether the trial judge is horribly wrong. Without even an additional one sheet of paper, how a man, two learned men, come to a different conclusion is very surprising.
Well, legal reform is an ongoing process, and we have been doing it regularly, and so far as criminal justice system is concerned, it needs a lot of improvement. Some improvements have already been done. Some improvements need to be carried out. Law Commission is already considering that proposal. Let us hope some good proposal will come, whereby life of the persons who are facing a trial becomes easier. Can we conclude it?
Yeah. Sure. Thank you so much, sir. We know, you know how valuable your time is. So hopefully we can continue this discussion through a more directed interaction where we can get the judges.
Thank you
again.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Waiting for Mr. Luka sir to join us.
Thank
so probably in the meanwhile, if anyone has other questions,
thank you very much.
Panel may want to take those at this point in time.
It's a pleasure hearing you.
Oh,
presented it very well. Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Ashish.
All the best. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. I have a question about the amendments or the proposed amendments to the Prevention of Corruption Act, and whether or not there is any discussion about having some provision for extraterritorial legislation, how that actually follows the responsibilities of domestic employees. Do people see there as being a possibility for including extraterritorial provisions in there along the lines of the FDPA and the UK budget?
So we haven't taken a close look at the prevention of corruption bills which have, amendments which have been proposed currently, but the focus which is initially there, as sir was saying, was to bring foreign companies and private companies which are there within the government companies within the ambit of the Act. So in regard to its extraterritorial application, probably not, that may not have been included at this stage. But we again probably check back and probably can get back to you on that one.
But there would be one aspect, Ashish. If it is Indian companies, you have a subsidiary or an operation outside India, it would be,
it would be covered
to that extent, subject to Indian law. Yeah.
Especially in case of UKBA and FCPA.
Yeah.
I think a little bit of extraterritorial creep will be natural with an act which governs Indian companies. And if the company is stepping outside India, the act, it can't kind of shirk the act of at the border of India.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's one of the key to the provisions of, let's say, UK Primary Act, the FCPA. Kind of idea of acting at arm's length, so if you have an Indian company operating anywhere in the world and you claim that you didn't know that your employees in that part of the world were doing something in a certain way, it's the same principle that you've all talked about today in terms of saying if you weren't at a board meeting, you have to actually take responsibility seriously, read the minutes, and if you don't put up any kind of complaint, then you're still liable. So I'd be interested to see how that develops, whether it's this bill or whether it's
the commercial dispute being a part of this provision of IPC. I have a live case wherein a VAT department of a particular state issued some notices to another company, and as we were in the process of contesting it, went and filed a complaint at the IPC with the CID, implicating the senior officials of this company. Now, when the prosecution there within the VAT Act also, what was the need or the urgency? I mean,
IPC is trying to regulate the company set of different violations, and the regulator is trying to deal with a completely different set of violations. It is through certain provisions that people are trying to bring that within the ambit of IPC. Obviously, there has to be, we have to develop mechanisms or something whereby we can stop it at the initial stage and not have the entire trial which is to be undertaken there.
No, you are right to an extent, in the sense that if you talk of the civil proceeding, then it is always the specialized which prevails over the general. But when it comes to the criminal part, then one transaction may have a multiple facet. So therefore, some facet may be covered under that specialized act, but there's some facets which may be covered under the IPC. So therefore, to generalize that and say that only the specialized one would apply, and once, for example, let's say that the under the specialized one, you are not coming within that ambit, it's not that the transaction may have a facet which may bring you under the provisions of IPC.
Do you have any
VAT law? Yes, VAT.
The Constitution will effectively
Yes.
They have a criminal intent and a ministry of interest. So the prosecution system law the way we use would not require the same level of ministry and that would require the IPT.
Yes.
But it is used as a mechanism for harassment.
Yes.
And under the judicial intervention which prevents the regulator from filing a case, it becomes very difficult for VS companies or directors or as KMP to file the cases.
I completely agree with you. In fact, not only VAT, income tax, central excise, service tax, all these, they are the criminal, income tax, criminal provisions are rarely used, very rarely used. But when it comes to service tax, Mr. Malhotra has left, it is being blatantly misused. So, you are,
yeah.
To an extent, you are right.
Absolutely. We've seen it in the
Sorry, we are running a little behind schedule. We now have with us Mr. Siddharth Hootra, senior advocate, Supreme Court of India, and the authority for criminal matters, you know, any matters we have, we definitely on the criminal side, you know, he's our first port of call. So just to brief you, we have in the room and on call about 50 people, mostly general counsels or directors and companies, and we've already, you know, had a panel discussion. We heard Mr. Malhotra. On the criminal side, we had discussion on the Bharati Mittal case, vicarious liability. But, you know, we wanted to give you the benefit of giving the concluding remarks, given you're there day in, day out, in the front line, you know, seeing what works and what doesn't work. So what can directors do, you know, and we've had a gentleman really worry about, you know, as independent directors, what do you do to prevent yourself, especially I think majority of the concerns here have been the kind of criminal liabilities that are coming up. And you do get into trouble, you know, what is your best defense line? With that, I'll hand it over to you.
Pratibha, Mr. Sareen, Mr. Chaudhary, Mr. Mohan, I must apologize, but in defense I can say that the courts, I was in court. The judge decided to sit a little later than he should have, and then he decided that after adjourning the matter, he wanted to hear it again. This is the story of a litigation lawyer. I heard Mr. Mohan talk about the service tax. I had occasion to appear in that matter recently, one of the matters where we got bailed. We ended up paying some. They paid some money. We paid about 40 crores in all, and it's a bizarre application of the law. Now, I must also apologize. I'm sorry I'm late, but I guess I'm a little bit of the Companies Act, like the Companies Act 2013. You waited for about six decades for it to change, and finally, after a lot of fits and starts, it came in 2013, and that too not in its entirety. So apologies once again to all of you for being late. I'm really sorry. A Friday evening is not a time to make any respectable people, and especially General Counsel, wait. That's the time when all of you need a break. And I'm really, once again, sorry for that. I made a PowerPoint presentation because I thought I'll go over the broad overview of the law, but I don't think we have the facility arrangement here. So not an issue. Not an issue. I am a little handicapped because my spectacles have not yet arrived, young man, and I've reached an age where one wants to be vain, but one needs to wear them.
So you're like the Companies Act coming in person.
Well, the company, I can only tell you, Pratibha, I was in court. I have changed just in this hotel because I requested somebody to get my suit from my office. I assumed that I would be done by 2:30. Today is one of those days, and I can only apologize. Every single court that I've been to has sat 2 hours beyond time. Or 1 hour beyond time, including
that's the good of judiciary trying to dispose.
Not when you have a commitment at 4:00 and you're still trying to panic and get out of court, sir. Otherwise, yes, but it's good. Now, I'll tell you what, let's look at this a little larger. The new Companies Act has come in. We had certain issues with the old Companies Act. One of the concerns was there were certain definitional issues, there were problems, the term officers in default. We had in the context not of Companies Act liabilities, but in IPC and other statute liabilities, we brought up through the courts a marriage between the concept of officer in default and the Companies Act. This started coming, you know, in 2000, 9, 10, 11, they started marrying those two concepts with liability. But it was an uneasy marriage because the whole issue was which are the directors liable. In most cases, directors were liable throughout in all cases. And it became, and occasionally one found that in a Companies Act prosecution or action, or even in an IPC action or other statute actions, either the whole board got stuck or nobody got stuck. So there was an aberration most of the time to the question of how they would apply the law. So a couple of the changes that have come is, of course, the amendment to the term officers in default. They made it a little more wholesome, which is, you know, saying that there has to be a whole-time director. There are some more changes that have come. And then again, where there are no, what the term uses, key managerial personnel, then directors who have given their consent are to be liable. So there are these two specific issues which are important for us. There are, of course, a number of provisions, 149, 150, on a data bank, independent directors, appointment of directors, and, you know, this DIN number, punishment for contravention. There are a number of provisions that have been brought in from in the new act which try and bring in certain safeguards, because the idea is to bring in safeguards not only for the directors but really for the shareholders, the people who we are acting on behalf of. And therefore, on the prospectus issue, public offers, issues, misstatements, experts, personation, deposits, there is a great focus on the new act on deposits. There's a great focus on the holding of AGMs and the consequential actions and stricter penalties. Then on accounts, on maintenance of the books of account, and investigations. One of the most important things is that investigations now, the SFIO was a creature which we didn't know what to do with. It was a creature outside the statute. Now for the first time it's been put in the statute, it's been given teeth. Of course, I must tell you that giving the SFIO teeth is one aspect. Is it adequately equipped to deal with the nuances of the Companies Act is a thing which we are going to learn as time goes by. And I, speaking for myself, and I can tell you this, I have been with the government, well, I've been in private practice, then I've had little stint with the government. I'm now a retired man and on my second innings in my career, but essentially retired. And in the course that I was, in the interregnum that I was not retired, I found that the SFI officials had, at least at that stage, even though the 2013 Act had come in, they had a narrower vision of their, even of their powers. Now that's something which needs to understand. So not only powers, but there has to be an understanding of responsibility, because powers exercised without responsibility, as he just mentioned, the service tax case, of course in a different context, but the way they've been dealt with, and I'm going to give you an aside on that. What is most astonishing, and I'm going to just give you an aside, is not that the issue there is on calculation of service tax. So what they say is, you should be treated in category X, not as tour operators, but whatever category, as people who have bulk hotels, which is ridiculous. What is fantastic is that in 2011, in other company, I don't want to name it because it's a professional assignment, in other company was issued a show cause notice as to the fact that they should be categorized as tour operators and not otherwise. So 2011, the very same department has penalized one of the companies for not taking a certain stand, and now that we are compliant with that stand of 2011, that the department said, you know, declare yourself as tour operators, pay taxes tour operators, which is what they're doing. Now they're being prosecuted 6 years hence for the very same thing. It's something which we need consistency in government, but that's something which unfortunately is sometimes missing. In fact, yes, I think I would agree. I'll just tell you one anecdote for a moment. When we had the Sarada case, and I was the additional solicitor general at that stage dealing with Sarada, it landed in my lap. So we had the ED, we had the SFIO also, which is company affairs that came in, and of course the CBI, which I was representing. So they landed in my lap and I asked them for instructions. So we got instructions, and one of the instructions one of the officers gave was, we are very keen. Short of saying they're very keen to investigate the matter, they were keen. I had to go back and tell them, I said, you know, we have 10 other cases in the last month that I've done for you where I've taken a stand that we are an organization, we have limited resources, you want us to deal with things in three states. If the other side get their hands on it, if the judge knows about those, they'll murder us. So please nuance it, leave it to the court to determine whether they want to transfer the investigation. Let's be fair. Leave it to the system. Finally, the judge felt that there was an investigation needed and directed us to investigate. But the point is, these kind of inconsistencies sometimes happen, and those are to be debated in a more informal forum, so I will not get into that. But to come back to what I was saying today. So we have a stricter penalty mechanism and stronger mechanisms now for the first time under this Act, because earlier the SFIO was not empowered, now it is an empowered body, the provisions are there, 217, 218 in the Act, and therefore these have given the Act a lot more teeth, which is good in a sense, but that goodness has to be tempered with fairness and balance. We have special courts. Now, what is the concept of special courts? I must tell you, and in a lighter way, in India we believe that we must give the same hat, make one person wear more than one hat. But in this case we've decided, and this seems to be a view taken, Mr. Malhotra was there, otherwise I would have teased him about it, but this seems to be a view taken in the law ministry that every time you want something, a legislation, to be more efficacious, you must appoint a session judge to do the trial. Two reasons. One is magistrates tend to be overburdened. There seem to be lesser work with sessions courts, and sessions courts are supposed to be more experienced, more mature. So to that extent, I think it's a great idea. It also takes away the aberration between the SEBI, because SEBI also deals with, the SEBI Act deals with insider trading. We have an insider trading provision, and there was this aberration between the magistrates trying cases here, in the Companies Act, sessions courts trying cases there. So that aberration was also there. But with this consistency, I think we'll have, it'll be easier for us, especially in, you know, in terms of insider trading, there'll be more consistency in government as to how and where you're to be prosecuted. But coming back, the idea to have a sessions court and a special court is A, to have specialization, B, to have speed, C, to have hoping that the judge will have domain knowledge. One of the things I will share with you is that when I started practice, which was a long time ago, I will not disclose my age, lest Pratibha start teasing me about it, but it was a long, long time ago. So when I was, before I became a fossil, there used to be commercial sub-judges, commercial civil judges in courts. That concept is gone. We used to have in the trial court a chief metropolitan magistrate or an additional chief metropolitan magistrate or a judicial magistrate who would be the company court. He would be the company court, he would be the income tax prosecution court, he would be the court for normal IPC offenses, and the gentleman, economic offenses being absolutely right, the gentleman or the lady concerned would not necessarily have the domain knowledge. As a result, there were aberrations and decisions, and we would be running from all the time to the High Court or the Sessions Court, and it would put people through a lot of harassment. I remember in my earlier days, the Oberoi Maidens, because this court was in Cesari in the district court, the Oberoi Maidens was a favorite hangout on every Friday. All these cases used to be listed on Friday, so the who's who of industry in Delhi, all the directors, used to be having lunch at Oberoi Maidens after suffering 2 hours or 3 hours in court. Now, these were the problems that you had, because you had somebody who would make a person wait for 2 hours, 3 hours, and being overburdened, there was no, matters were not just moving, and most of these were either compoundable or fine-related matters. So I believe that this provision of special courts is a great thing. Now, along with this, we've opened up the definition of fraud. So there are stricter penalties for false statements, false evidence. Pratibha, tell me when you want to end. And this has come because of two important matters, one which I've had occasion to be a part of, Satyam. The other is, of course, Enron. You know them all. I don't need to tell you the history. But these are things which have really hit us, and that's the reason. One of the questions that was asked repeatedly was, don't you have any mechanism under the Companies Act to take account situations like Satyam? And the answer effectively was, it was either the Economic Offences Wing of Police which was doing it, and there was need for, in that sense, a regulation. Another concern that has been addressed at some length under the new Act is, of course, insider trading, which I'm sure you've dealt with. But what's relevant for us is, insider trading includes directors, key managerial personnel, and there are large, large fines and penalties for. Now, I'm not going to get into the definition of fraud, but just to point out that today the SFIO has large, large ranging powers, and that's investigation 235, 237, looking into related companies, then there's an investigation by the registrar, And of course, the power to call for information, conducting investigation. There are so many powers even with the registrar under the Companies Act. Another thing that's come, which is a little troublesome, is for the first time, the SFIO has the power to arrest, to take remand. Now, this is a serious problem. I wish they had built in our safeguards that arrest is not something to be done routinely, remand is not to be taken routinely, and court should also be sensitized that, let's be practical, in a case where the amounts are large, remand is given for the asking. And having done about, as I said, more than 2 decades at the bar, this is a reality we need to live with. Judges don't want to appreciate, judges are not often sensitized to the fact that what they are dealing with is a purely non-criminal, non-penal issue. And it's a matter which needs to be resolved in a different domain. It may not even be a technical breach as such. But the fact is, these issues need to be done. This is a serious concern I have as to the use and abuse of this power and the impact, because throughout this act, we have provisions making officers in default, and especially directors and even independent directors liable. There are responsibilities cast also on independent directors. The old act did not make them liable. We used to keep arguing that I'm an independent director, I'm a nominated director, but today in the 2013 act, that position is reversed. Of course, liability is only for those acts occurring with your knowledge, attributable through broad processes, and with consent or connivance, or where you didn't act diligently. But what are these words? These words really put the onus on you. Now, this is a big concern. And let me tell you, this is a standard vicarious liability position provision which I've seen. And I've seen this provision, at least the first provision that I recall seeing it in, I'm sure there are earlier ones, is the 1923 Official Secrets Act. Now, the world of companies has changed. Should we really stick down to this old hierarchy or this old concept? That's something which we need to see. I've already dealt with the special court, so I won't trouble you. But when one looks at the Act, whether it be 448, which is, you know, false statements, false evidence, and the other liabilities, 448, 449, there are liabilities from prospectus to deposit to transmission of securities to making, furnishing false statements, liability for conduct of business, fraudulent conduct of business. These offenses are non-cognizable, of course, but, and there are fines, but we have serious concerns with the number of offenses that have been included and retained in the Act. And of course, that means that in most of these offenses, there are two problems. Some, of course, say the directors are going to be liable, and some say any person. So that includes the directors. Let the directors not think that they may not be liable if they have given that undertaking as is required under the law.
In fact, it will also include the auditors now.
Absolutely. So the auditors may also be liable. If the auditors are not doing their job, again the liability comes on the directors. There's provision for that as well.
That is why the concept of any person.
Yes, absolutely. Now, these things cause some amount of concern, and we, of course, have the whistleblower policy and other mechanisms within the Act. But what I really want to tell you is that an increased penalization in a law, strengthening a law doesn't necessarily create a mechanism where the law is going to be obeyed. Unfortunately, the legislative history of India is that whenever we believe that there is aberrant conduct, we believe that we must increase the penalties, increase the onus, increase the noose around people's necks. Now, that in context, what do we do about directors and independent directors? The Act also, and that's the beneficial part of the Act, sets out necessary requirements and due diligence duties. So if the directors don't exercise that due diligence, if the auditors do not exercise their due diligence, and the directors do not apply their mind to it, it's not the concept of chalta hai, hota hai, you know, which the way a lot of companies have been run in the past, especially smaller companies tend to be run in the past. It's sometimes a nightmare as a practicing lawyer when you ask somebody, you know, have you got your resolution and your minute books in place? Now, it's all very well for public limited companies, it's all very well for companies which are quoted on the stock exchange. But for the other companies, let me assure you, the state of affairs of the papers is a lawyer's worst nightmare. Most actions lie because of the way we don't maintain our records and the way things are operated. So I think it's time. The new Act has come. It's still a lot of the provisions need to come in. But one of the paramount things is it's now very clear that the law whether it applies to directors or independent directors, puts a greater onus on you. It's time to wake up, it's time to take charge of your responsibilities, and it's time to be aware of the provisions of the Act and ensure its enforcement by the rest of the board and by the other functions of the companies. Otherwise, the consequences will be direct. So I'm going to end now and I'll leave the floor open for any questions.
Thank you. So we'll open up to questions. We'll just check if there are any questions on the phone.
Sure. Participants, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and one. Any participant who'd like to ask a question, please press star and one. Ma'am, we don't have any questions.
Okay, great, thanks. We'll open it up in the room. If I may start with the first question. So do you think with the codifications, see today at least you have an outline of what is it that is the duty of an independent director? And more and more codification of the duties of directors. Do you see the jurisprudence developing around that to be able to put some method to the madness today with respect to the duties of directors?
I've already said I believe that the codification and the effort made to try and delineate the nature of responsibilities and duties is a positive act. Perhaps there could have been a little greater clarity in it, and perhaps more will need to be done. And as the law is applied and the courts determine it, we'll find areas where we will need possibly correction, and that's something which is going to be an ongoing process. But it's important that this codification has come, and I think that jurisprudence is going to help us develop and develop our company law in a more positive fashion. The ambiguity, the gaps in the previous legislation had become horrifying in a situation where we are a country where today we are very company driven. That's the nature of work. We've shifted from the older mechanisms of doing business to a corporate world, and that therefore it was important and essential to bring in these and perhaps still further changes. I also have one more thing to add. One of the concerns I have is, and I think all of you people are very important, responsible people, one of the concerns I have is, and perhaps this should have been done even when the law was being enacted and still should be considered, why criminal prosecutions, except in the rarest of cases? Let me give you an example. A few years ago, I was lecturing at SEBI, and I asked them, I said, how many cases do you prosecute in? Because they have much higher penalty provisions, they have chosen to prosecute in the minimal cases. They just don't want to prosecute. They find it much easier to go through the civil penalty route, and people can get back. They pay the penalty. If necessary, they get back to business. But that they're finding is a greater and a better mechanism against reoccurrence of offenses. Yet, this desire to bring in criminal prosecution, I'm not complaining. It keeps me busy. But otherwise,
a classic example is FERA versus FEMA.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It was a draconian law where people used to get arrested for an economic offense. And many a times it is not intentional. You know, you may, you know, miss some of the provisions of law for which I do agree that there's no need for criminal prosecution.
Well, the difficulty is we have that in PMLA today.
Yeah.
I recently had a lawyer seek an opinion where his concern was he was expecting, his client said they were having certain financial troubles and they were expecting some action from the investigating agencies and they were apprehending PMLA would be applied. So they told the lawyer, why didn't you take the fee up front? And keeping in view that the fee had to be paid for an annual retainer and a substantial amount, I had to tell him not to do that because the fear was, how are you going to justify it? Otherwise, you'll be sitting before the ED and giving responses. The law doesn't exempt lawyers as well. So unfortunately, FERA is gone, but we have an equally draconian problem in PMLA. Perhaps it was necessary for the system, but it has its own serious consequences, and the language of PMLA is very wide, very dangerously wide.
And the live example is the Nalini Chidambaram's cuisine that is taking place. In that capacity as an advisor.
Sorry?
That was also in the capacity as an advisor.
In which one?
Sarda.
Sir, I don't want to comment on that for various reasons.
No,
no, no. I must tell you, I had been a lawyer for the CBI at that stage.
Yes, yes, yes.
And I because I know this is an issue, and that's the difficulty. When you receive that amount, even as a professional, you have to be willing to justify it.
Absolutely.
If you receive a large amount.
Yes.
But this is the peculiarity of PMLA. Yes, sir?
All the laws. In India, some of the acts cannot be complied with the law or employment agency act. And there are so many acts that cannot be complied. You expect a man like company secretary or the director to be responsible for a whole lot of law which he may not know also.
I must give you, sorry,
I think we need to read the provision.
Yeah.
The company secretary, he is not duty bound to get, he has to put a system in place and inform the board that there is a system which is existing, because it is not physically possible or humanly possible to ensure 100% compliance. While we target, there will always be something which, you know, you are not in a position to comply because of, you know, typically like for power plants, there is a stipulation that you have to dispose 100% fly ash. Most of the power plants in the country are not able to, the larger ones are not able to comply because you need, you know, avenues to dispose that. And just to give an example, so company secretary or director, I, you know, Mr. Luthra can further elaborate, they will not be held responsible. They have to ensure that there is a system and there is a
and
system
it's working.
Of reporting.
And so
it's working.
Reporting.
So any non-compliance is getting reported and the board is questioning that what is your plan for, you know, making it compliant. Responsibility will lie with the person who is ultimately responsible.
I concur with what he's saying. I want to clarify one thing. You know, you said you can't know all the law, but that's not the answer. As a citizen, as professionals, we are supposed to be, knowledge of the lack of knowledge of the law is no excuse. That's not a defense available, unfortunately. If it was, a lot of people would not be prosecuted at all. That's the first thing. The second thing which I want to tell you is, whether it be a director, after all, I'll give you an example. Look at the provision on audits on a director. The auditors are supposed to function. There are requirements to how an audit is to be carried out. And if that is not done, then the directors need to ensure that it is done. That's all. They have to oversee that the auditors are doing their duty. It's not that the directors have to sit and do the auditor's duty. It's a question of making sure that compliances, requirements of law are met. And this is something which we should have realized, because way back, in 1995 or 6, you had the case of JK Industries, that boilers case. I don't know if you recall.
Yes, yes.
And the boilers case's issue of the governing mind, the think in the mind of the company, was brought up. And in India, by and large, what we've done is, we say the company is liable, hence the directors are liable. Whereas in the Western world, they say, look, if X is liable and he is the governing mind, then they transfer the liability backwards. Now, this is something which we will have to live with, not only in this legislation, but in a number of legislations which have been contemplated. I can share with you the Law Commission, which I was assisting as one of the subcommittee members, was reconsidering and recalibrating the Criminal Procedure Code. And one of the things in the law that was being deliberated, even in the corruption law at one stage, was whether to have that kind of provision. So that's something which we will have to live with. Therefore, it becomes very important that whatever is the domain of our responsibility on this little book, we need to follow it, or similar other books, we need to follow it and ensure compliance. It's not just paper compliance.
Reverse will not be true. That is what the Supreme Court, the recent Supreme Court just said.
Yes.
Bharti's case, yes.
You see, Bharti's case, let me tell you one thing about Bharti's case, and I must clarify one thing. Bharti's case is a penal code case. It doesn't have a vicarious liability provision.
Yes,
it doesn't have an officer in default position. It's on a totally distinct footing. And while it draws from a lot of the law in vicarious liability provisions, it's actually not a, it's not a judgment in that context. And that's something which we must reconsider when we read Bharti's case. At first blush, I find increasingly in court, Bharti's judgment is being used as a case to say,
yes,
you should, as a case that, you know, you shouldn't prosecute anybody under any law where there's liability. But that's not the, I mean, it's a discussion of the law, but that's not the conclusion. It's on a different point altogether. In fact, on the issue that there is no vicarious liability in the penal code, there must be about half a dozen or more decisions before and a few after. The most classic one is an old one. One of the ones I remember is, I think 2003, Hiralal Harilal Bhagwati. That said the same thing in one sentence.
No, no, but the judgment itself clarifies that unless there is a specific provision in this statute.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, that is, to give a parallel example, like, you know, you have got one section 322 in a South African penal provision, where it clearly says it's not the reverse flow, as, you know, Supreme Court has said there. They say that in case you are controlling the affair, you are the guilty mind, then you shall be held responsible. The reverse gear will not apply to the company.
Argument proposed by Salve, which was adopted by the Supreme Court.
Correct, correct. Yes. Yes. Salve got it. Absolutely.
The reverse mechanism is what?
Correct, correct.
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you very much for taking out time from your paid work to come and, you know, help us navigate through the dangers of the new act, and, you know, hopefully over time, you know, you've missed Mr. Malhotra, but when we brought about the issues of, you know, major lacunas in the act today in terms of, you know, being overreaching, his view was, he had two views, one on the criminal issue, but on this, it was, he felt that we have to go through at least, you know, some amount of pain before we learn how to walk this and actually see if what we think our pains are lacunas or it needs to be amended or not. And I think what has been more interesting was because he did feel that our laws are fine as far as the Indian Penal Code is concerned. It's the implementation that is an issue.
I think I think Mr. Malhotra and I had this discussion, and to some extent I do tend to agree with him that the application of the law is a serious concern. The width that the law is being given, you know, the Indian Penal Code is not law in this country alone. It's law in 34 countries in some form or the other. I've had occasion to settle appeals which are filed in Malaysia as well on the IPC. But you're lucky to have Mr. Malhotra, and I must compliment you on that, because while I worked with him in the government, I found him to be not only very proactive, but he listens with an open mind, and he understands the issues that arise and the concerns, because prior to him, we found, prior to his taking over as law secretary, and even when I was in the legislative department before that, one would find that there was a lot of cut-paste happening in legislation. It's not that it doesn't happen now. It happens occasionally. But there is an attempt to put a greater application of mind to foresee things of the future. But it's a dynamic issue. We'll have to live and learn it, unfortunately, for some of us.
And the third point where I really wished you were there was the composition of NCLT. You know, he assured us all that the process is done, and, you know, it's going to be, it's good selections, and it's going to help streamline the process. So I think that's something for all of us to wait and see.
I must tell you, even, for example, I don't know whether you're aware, but I think even in the Competition Commission, you've got a very good person who's come in. Mr. Sikri, I worked with him when he was Secretary of Justice, and I think you'll find him even there. Since a lot of you will have worked there, you'll find him to be a positive and a dynamic chap. Yes, sir.
You know, most of the listed companies are otherwise, many professionals have been worked by independent directors, whether they are not chartered or not, I guess. Whether this is the transition from the old act to the new act, many are caught in the web of law. Their cases are being filed against them and so on. Is there any new cases which is coming up which you experience how to get out of this?
Sir, right now the law, the application of the law is at the nascent stage. There are no real great cases. I'm talking about independent actors, sir. There is no great determination of the scope of liabilities. But at the end of the day, you know, when the law changes, unfortunately for us, the way the system operates is the day it's notified, you are supposed to have knowledge of the law. All that requires is a gazette notification. And then it's, if you're working as an independent actor, you have to acquaint yourself with your responsibilities. I think it's really essential for all companies to sensitize the independent directors and tell them, these are your responsibilities. We're in a new regime. Please look at it more carefully. It's time for you to ensure complete participation. It's not just about coming, having a visit, having a cup of coffee, signing off and leaving. So it's a two-way process. The companies will have to be responsible, because at the end of the day, the companies have to also move forward. And good governance in companies is something which I think all of us as citizens hope for, don't we?
And globally, you know, one, because this is not unique to India, independent directors even globally have, you know, liability. And increasingly, even under Sarbanes-Oxley, the liability, for example, in New York is very high for directors, independent directors. Use experts. That's something we miss doing in India. You know, we all look to internal auditors and external auditors, and that's the end of it. But pretty much you have experts today for all fields applicable to your business, to governance, you know, capable lawyers. So really, as an independent director, to cover yourself, because, you know, once you have a report, you just have to read the report and you can say you relied on an expert. But you have to ensure that the company hires those experts.
And I think the independent directors will also have to show a level of inner strength. I don't know if you recall, there was a recent case where in a society, in a trust in Delhi, very prominent case where there was an issue of sexual harassment, and one of the independent board members resigned over that. They believed that what was being done was not appropriate, and therefore the independent board member took a view, and that's a view independent directors will have to take. You know, they can't just go through the motions. It's time to wake up, because there is a serious responsibility cast under the act. And that applies across the board to all directors.
On this note, we'll close for this day. Thank you very much for everybody in the room, on the phone, for, you know, spending all this time on a Friday. On that note, invite everybody for cocktails outside. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes the conference call. You may now disconnect your lines.